It is with devout but sure confidence that I say, let God defend the right.
I will say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God. Humanly speaking, victory was impossible. And that was during the week following our third National Day of Prayer. And the newspapers were not afraid to print that statement by Dowding.
Hello, I'm Pam Rhodes. Welcome to episode 4 of When We Prayed in World War II, a podcast from the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer, produced by Premier. In this series, we're looking at the history of World War II through the lens of prayer. We'll examine the progress of the war, using as our guide the 7 National Days of Prayer called by King George VI during the conflict.
I desire to call my people to prayer and dedication.
We'll find out when and why the king asked his people to look to God for help. And we'll investigate some of the remarkable things that happened after the British nation was brought to its knees in prayer. The response to the first National Day of Prayer in May 1940 was incredible. Churches were packed, and the queue to get into Westminster Abbey went round the block. And do you remember, it was immediately after returning from that service that Winston Churchill reconvened the War Cabinet for their second meeting of the day. Within hours of the nation praying, his chiefs of staff quashed thoughts of surrendering to Hitler, and the War Cabinet had hope again. Over the next few days, the water in the English Channel seemed to be miraculously stilled, and thousands of Allied troops were delivered from deadly peril in Dunkirk. You can listen back to episode 1 to hear more about it, but General Alan Brooke was one of the men leading the British Expeditionary Force at the time, who, writing later, said,
"As I look back on those days before Dunkirk, I still marvel at the fortune we had. I should always remain convinced that had it not been for the guiding hand of an almighty providence, the BEF would have never left the shores of France. Repeatedly throughout the war, I realized the influence of this guiding hand, this same superhuman power, watching and guiding the destiny of humanity."
And someone called C.B. Mortlock wrote to the Daily Telegraph saying,
"Officers of the highest rank, do not hesitate to put down the deliverance of the BEF to the fact of the nation being at prayer."
There's a humbling there, isn't there, in the nation, in the king going to God and calling the whole nation to go to God and saying, we can't do this on our own strength. He's saying, we need to humbly ask for God to help us, as has happened in the past in this nation, and now we must do it again in this time of crisis.
That's Tim Dieppe, who wrote the book Beyond the Odds about some of the miraculous stories from Britain's wars, with the historian John Scriven, whose father survived Dunkirk.
Well, we do know from history that King George VI was a man of deep personal faith, and calling for that day of prayer just before Dunkirk shows that he wasn't afraid to humble himself before God, nor too proud to encourage his people to do the same, especially when they had nowhere else to turn.
So, a few months later, with the Battle of Britain raging overhead, King George was inspired to call the nation to pray once again on the 8th of September 1940. The sovereign had intended this day of prayer to mark the first anniversary of the war. When he announced it, the king could not have known, but by the time dawn broke that Sunday morning, the British people, especially those in London, would face a much greater and more urgent need to pray. The eve of that National Day of Prayer was the beginning of what became known as the Blitz.
Well, throughout the summer of 1940, the Battle of Britain had been testing the RAF and its reserves to their limit. By September, the Allies' last line of defence was wearing thin.
Calling for another day of prayer so soon showed how desperate Parliament knew the situation to be.
Throughout this series, we've been hearing excerpts from the journals of the Reverend Dr. Victor Pearce, who recorded all of the days of prayer and the events around them in his diary. These are his reflections 2 months into the Nazis' attempt to establish air supremacy over Britain.
The answer was immediate.
Fighter Command only needed a day or two to recover their strength and rebuild their reserves, and they got it.
Air Chief Marshal Dowding said, "I will say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God." Humanly speaking, victory was impossible. And that was during the week following our National Day of Prayer. And the newspapers were not afraid to print that statement by Dowding.
Well, one of the answers to prayer was that the RAF's battered airfields got a crucial reprieve. It was bittersweet, though. In response to a raid on Berlin, the Luftwaffe's bombing campaign was switched from the airfields to London.
The noise of the engines fell silent over the British countryside. And interestingly, in their place, something quite remarkable appeared overhead, as Reverend Dr. Pearce records.
It was during this period that people in the streets began to see angels in the sky.
A newspaper clipping with the headline, "Strangest Story of the War," was saved by Dr. Pearce, and it reads,
"Mr. Fowler of Firle Lewis was attending his sheep on the Sussex Downs when he noticed a white line spreading slowly across the sky. Gradually to his eyes it took the shape of Christ crucified on the cross. Then six angels took form. The apparition lasted for 2 minutes, then faded. Mr. Fowler rushed down the hillside to tell the village, but found he was not the only witness. Villagers working on the land said that they had also seen it. A New Haven evacuee, Mrs. Steer of the street, Firle, and her sister, Mrs. Evans, said, 'We could see the nail in the crossed feet of Christ, and one of the angels with arms upstretched appeared to be praying.'" Similar statements were made by 7 other villagers.
It's not the first time shepherds have seen angels, and some were not convinced by their story this time either. But later in the war, the same thing happened again. 2 very similar sights were recorded, one in Peckham, South London, and the other in Ipswich. Each time the newspaper reports were of an apparition of Jesus on a white cross, and it was seen by several independent witnesses. It's not clear what the purpose or message of those angelic visions was, but we know that the first ones appeared shortly after the entire nation had prayed, and that this was at an absolutely critical moment in the war. Unbeknown to the vast majority of people praying in Britain, Hitler was only a hair's breadth from victory at this point.
It's reported that 4 years later, when Allied troops were fighting their way through Normandy to liberate Europe, they came across a locked garage in Belgium. Inside, they found piles and piles of paper, thousands of maps and instructions, details of Germany's planned invasion of Britain by land and sea, known as Operation Sea Lion. Hitler had been planning for months. The maps were never used in battle, but their discovery under layers of dust after D-Day is proof of just how advanced the strategy was in the summer of 1940.
And now, with the benefit of history and hindsight, we also know that within hours of that day, so a week and a bit after the day of prayer, an even more important moment happened out of sight, over in Europe. On September the 17th, Hitler gave the order to scrap plans for a ground invasion of Britain. Historical archive shows that he called it a postponement, but the Nazis' plans to overtake Britain were finished. They would never be resumed. And just look at the chronology.
Well, Sunday, the 8th of September, with the RAF on its last legs and the Nazis breathing down Britain's neck, we know that Britain's churches were filled with people praying at the encouragement of the King. The following Sunday came Britain's finest hour, prophetically declared by Churchill with such extraordinary foresight, when the RAF found the strength to defend the skies against the best the Nazis could throw at them. The Luftwaffe had been told that RAF Fighter Command was down to its last 50 Spitfires, but they encountered 180 fighters over London and 300 or more over southeastern counties on that day. Professor Philip Williamson at the University of Durham undertook extensive research of Britain's National Days of Prayer. His work was published in 2013. He writes that the National Days of Prayer were not simply generated by national leaders and the media, but by many members of the public who sent requests for them to be organised. He quotes Michael Snape, Professor of Anglican Studies at Durham and official historian to the Royal Army Chaplain's Department, who said that these occasions were notable expressions of public religiosity. All places of worship of every religious community held at least one and often several special services, generally using prayers or complete liturgies composed and published especially for the day. On the day of prayer on the 8th of September 1940, a service was held in Westminster Abbey. It was conducted by the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Battle of Britain was at its climax at this point, and his final prayer was for the airmen. It began, "Remember, O God, for good, these watchmen who by day and by night climb into the air. Let thy hand lead them, we beseech thee, and thy right hand hold them." And that prayer was answered when the Battle of Britain was won a week later. But also from that day, the weather in the Channel deteriorated, holding back the German invasion plans. Sometimes we don't know or see the many ways in which God is answering our prayers. As St. Paul says, we only see through a glass darkly. And while we're on earth, we have to leave the mystery with God.
One of the miracles reported at the time of the Dunkirk rescue was how the waters of the Channel were remarkably stilled to enable so many small boats to sail safely. And now the weather, once again, was in the Allies' favour. Here's Reverend Dr. Pierce's account from the time.
Goering, the Nazi commander, expected success, and in anticipation, Hitler had prepared invasion barges at Bremen. But I see in my notes taken at the time that a terrific storm in the Channel and North Sea blew away those invasion barges. The result was that the invasion of Britain was postponed. This was vital, for it gave Britain more time to manufacture armaments to re-equip our depleted forces.
With hindsight, we can see just how close they came to a different outcome.
Never in the field of human conflict.
And perhaps how important the timing of that day of prayer really was.
Was so much owed by so many to so few.
During the Blitz, St. Paul's Cathedral became a national symbol of survival and resistance. As the children's author Mrs. Robert Henry recalls in her book London Under Fire, published in 1969, a trilogy of her wartime accounts.
From the very first night of the battle for London, because of the fires in the east which lit up the dome, St. Paul's Cathedral had become a symbol of London's defiance. Almost every evening, from the flat roof of Carrington House, we peered east and prayed that it might stand.
The dean of the cathedral before and during the war years was a man called Walter Matthews, who later wrote about the role that St. Paul's played for the nation at the time.
The days of prayer appointed during the war were observed in St. Paul's and attracted large numbers of people, in spite of the difficulties and the dangers of the times. I do not think that any of us will forget what St. Paul's with its dome and cross meant in the darkest days of the war. It seemed then a daily miracle that it should survive. On the 12th of September 1940, a high explosive bomb fell very close to the Southwest Tower. It narrowly missed the tower by a few feet and penetrated deep below the road, reaching a depth of 27 feet and 6 inches below the surface. It did not explode and was removed on the 15th of September and taken to Hackney Marshes, where it was blown up, leaving a crater 100 feet in diameter.
The event was well documented. Mrs. Henry remembered it well.
The night of the 12th of September, a large delayed action bomb hurtled down south of the granite posts and buried itself 27 feet deep. Everybody knew that if it exploded, there would be nothing left of St. Paul's.
The history blog, A London Inheritance, puts it in architectural terms.
Had the bomb exploded on impact, it would almost certainly have taken out the whole of the Southwest Tower and much of the west front of the cathedral.
For 3 days, men worked to dig it out. Then it was driven in state to Hackney Marshes on a lorry under the command of Lieutenant Davis, a Canadian who became a national hero.
And did you catch the date, the 12th of September? Just 4 days earlier, on Sunday the 8th, the church had been packed with people praying for God's protection and deliverance. We can't say for sure that the two were linked, but no one can deny that the timing is interesting. St. Paul's was hit several more times during the nightly bombing raids of 1940 and 41, but miraculously, it remained standing. The worst night for St. Paul's was the 29th of December, known as the Great Raid.
St. Paul's during that night provided the most inspiring and terrifying sight that Londoners had ever seen. At times, the dome seemed to ride the waves like a galleon and the Golden Cross to scintillate above the reach of earthly harm.
When Mr. and Mrs. Henry ventured out after a sleepless night, they found the city's landscape irrevocably changed, with one exception.
St. Paul's Cathedral, as if under divine protection, stood intact.
Author and historian Juliet Gardiner, in her book The Blitz, records office worker Dorothy Barton, who was quoted by a Daily Mail reporter after seeing St. Paul's the following morning.
I felt a lump in my throat because, like so many people, I felt that while St. Paul's survived, so would we.
That it did survive was a daily hope and inspiration, and a symbol that the Christian way of life should not perish. The great fane was not unscathed, but ever the cross shone, a beacon which seemed to be the emblem of the undying spirit of this scarred and battered city, this ever-resurgent city, a symbol of endurance to a nation so valiant in action, so steadfast in adversity.
Very early in the war, Matthews had recruited his own bespoke task force to be on duty in the cathedral during an air attack. Juliet Gardiner explains Matthews' plan.
He called for men from 40 to 60 years of age who can walk upstairs and not fear heights. Each volunteer was requested to spend one night a week in the cathedral from 9:30 until 6 in the morning. But when the blitz started, most came in on two nights or more, so usually there were about a dozen on duty each night.
The St. Paul's Fire Watch, as they were named, could not have done anything about that massive bomb that disappeared underground instead of exploding. That was definitely something of a miracle. But the watch, as they were known, do deserve some of the credit for preserving the St. Paul's we know today. Gardiner describes a dramatic moment the men encountered during the Great Raid when 28 incendiary bombs found their target.
One stuck in the lead covering of the dome and, blazing away, it gave the impression that the whole dome was on fire. Two teams of the watch crawled cautiously along the wooden beams with stirrup pumps to try to extinguish the incendiary device. It was perilous work, high above the nave, balancing on a slender beam. Members of the dome patrol were selected from amongst those with a head for heights, with a leaning towards acrobatics.
Some of the watchers were members of the clergy, and they were now perilously suspended. Hundreds of metres up in the air, above the transepts, where they'd probably conducted services a few days earlier. So now they're in pitch darkness, engaged in a death-defying rescue stunt, balanced on a burning beam. It's a bit beyond the call of duty, and you can only imagine how they must have prayed at that moment.
Suddenly, having burst its way through the beam, the bomb crashed onto the floor below, where it was easily put out.
Another prayer answered. Another crisis averted. Was it thanks to God's providence? Or chance? Or the firefighters' skill and daring? And can a building be saved by God to be used for his purposes? The morning after the 29th, as firefighters were still dousing the flames in and around St Paul's, news photographer Herbert Mason climbed onto a nearby rooftop and took the iconic photo of the dome rising up through clouds of smoke. Juliet Gardner quotes dispatch rider Stan Hook, who stopped to survey the scene.
The dome was silhouetted against a blood-red sky, and it showed up black, and the cross on the top. The orb was reflecting all the flames around, and it gave you hope.
After the war, Walter Matthews explained how the cathedral staff honoured the service of the watch.
At the other end of the cathedral, we put up our own domestic commemorative tablet. In the floor, we have it set, just by the Great West Door, a stone with a simple inscription. Remember men and women of St Paul's Watch, who by the grace of God preserved this cathedral from destruction, 1939 to 1945.
By the grace of God. The inscription can be found in the floor of the cathedral at the western end, in the very section which almost didn't survive. The When We Prayed podcast by the Eternal Wall of Answered Prayer is produced by Premier. Join us for more stories of answered prayer as we continue to trace the history of the National Days of Prayer called through the war. You can like, share and review this podcast. And if you hit the subscribe button and turn on notifications, you'll receive an update when more episodes become available. The series producer is Ross Mayfield. Sound engineer is Bradley Howard. And the presenter is me, Pam Rhodes. To find out more about the Eternal Wall or to share your story of answered prayer, go to eternalwall.org.uk or see the information in the show notes. Thank you for listening and see you again next time.